joy.
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 What is joy?
And can we truly discover it in the hallowed halls of academia?
In this podcast, we seek to answer these questions.
Join us as we chat with academics about the little pockets of joy they discovered along their academic career.
This is Joy in Academia with your hosts,
Zekia Senhaji,
Onur Şahin,
Zehra Çolak,
Dauri van Veen,
and Dunya Boraben.
Sponsored by Utrecht University, Migration and Societal Change Platform.
Hi everyone, my name is Zehra Çolak. I work as a postdoctoral researcher and lecturer at Utrecht University in the Department of Education.
And I am Dauri van Veen, and I'm an assistant professor at Utrecht University at the Department of Interdisciplinary Social Science.
We are very excited to be joined today by Derwin Lynch, who is a PhD candidate working at Athena Institute at the Free University of Amsterdam. He's also a researcher at the Representing Europe project. So in theory, he's one of my colleagues, but we do not see each other that often because his research is situated in a work package where the focus is on healing in postcolonial contexts. And I am in a work package where the focus is on sense of belonging in education. In addition to his research, Derwin is also actively involved in community work to increase collective awareness about the emotional consequences of colonial past in the Netherlands. So we are looking forward to learning more about his research on healing as well as community-oriented work and hear his reflections on the connections between healing and joy. So welcome, Derwin. Thank you so much for being here with us today. How is your week going so far?
Thanks for the invite and good afternoon or good day to everyone or to you listening. My day today, my week?
It could be your day, it could be your week. So depending on what was it a joyful start to the week or to the day?
Life, let's call it like that, life. No, it's good, c'est bon, what I said in the beginning as well. Busy, lots of things going on. In Dutch, we say that herdenkingsjaar, a commemoration year. So there are many activities related to that nice introduction you had of me. And that keeps me busy.
Nice to hear. So we first would like to start with a question about your academic journey. How did you find your way into academia?
How did I find my way into academia? For me, it started going to the university as a normal step after the secondary school. Not really thinking about that's also the place where I would like to work. I saw it as a necessary step to further my career. I wanted to become a pilot, an airplane pilot. And my mom really kind of like advised me in the beginning. I'm not sure if that is really something that, that suits you entirely. Maybe you should definitely go for your university degree. She found that important and installed quite some values in me to appreciate that as well. But coming to the Netherlands, because I did my secondary school in the Caribbean, in Curaçao. Coming to the Netherlands, I thought, okay, let's do this broad bachelor. It was called Science and Innovation Management. And after my bachelor, I would go for the pilot study. Now, that plan didn't really work out. And it was after my bachelor that I went for a master. And during my master, I was introduced to PhD. I never before thought of it. And that's when the world of academia opened for me.
You said you were introduced to PhD. How? Who did introduce you?
It's a possible step.
Was it your supervisor or was it someone that you knew or did you see the vacature and did you think like, okay, this looks interesting?
Somehow, how strange this may sound, it was during my master's that I realized, some go further in the university and then they do this PhD and that entails this and that and that. It's not something that I really thought of entirely at all, actually, during my bachelor's. So it was then when one door closes, you look at, okay, what do I have in my own pocket, in my own being, and what suits me? What are doors that are opening for me, possibilities that I now see? I don't come from a family where my parents or my uncles and my aunts went to the university to hear how they speak about their work during family gatherings or so. So I never got that inspiration. But I had a supervisor during my thesis, during my internship, Barbara Regeer, who, what can I say? She opened my own mind to theoretical frameworks, conceptual models, a very boring topic in research. But somehow seeing all those possibilities over there and what interpretations people make out of those, but also try to understand the world from that, Looking back now, I realized that I saw a world where I could fly into, you know, an academic world where you could fly conceptually. And that's when it started to grow.
I like that analogy. You know, you mentioned at first you were interested in becoming a pilot. Now, in terms of perhaps a bit symbolically, right, you saw the possibility to fly within an academic setting. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that? Was it like a sense of freedom, or what is it that drew you in about this idea of the theoretical models and thinking in that kind of fashion?
I did my bachelor's at Utrecht University. That was the first university that I saw in my life. Looking back, I think I experienced that institute, that campus, the same way as I would watch now a North Korean movie and see those buildings, like Soviet-ish even, like, what am I doing here? Am I allowed to be here? Go out as soon as possible. Some conditioning. So those layers of removing those thoughts that I had of this institute where I always felt, maybe I'm just really a number, started to come down. You know, I saw possibilities that I am an explorative person. I'm open-minded, so I'm open to this new possibility. But it wasn't something that I thought, hey, it's natural for you to work in the university or to work in the academia. So I guess enabling my own path to what academia is and seeing as well that my interpretations of such a building, such an institute became more vague. That's how it went a bit. What was the question again?
Well, in terms of what attracted you in terms of these theoretical models and such?
Oh, of the theoretical models. That has to do with Pauli interpretation. It's a word that I was introduced to already in secondary school. That people can have different meanings on different interpretations on different stuff, on the same stuff. And with theoretical frameworks and models, you get to understand how people or communities reason, and you get to understand complexity of issues. And that piece of understanding from the more traditional way that I saw the university, where you can just go and become a lawyer, a doctor. No, there are also people who really think more in depth on how certain constructions of concepts are related and what it actually means to people. That's still a plane that a field that I'm diving into, and I still get very excited when I teach when I teach about theoretical frameworks and guide students on that particular part.
Oh, we're quite interested, of course, in like your research and your expertise, where you know you yourself get to peel back these layers for others to help people understand things. So your research focuses on healing in the aftermath of colonization, particularly in the context of the Netherlands. Can you tell us more about your research?
Yeah. So Zara introduced me as a PhD candidate. My PhD is not on that topic. My PhD is on public engagement in science, and I'm looking there really into the subtopics, the subdomains of bioeconomy and waste management. My to-be postdoc, which I already started, is on healing afterlives of colonialism, way more central to the communities where I belong to. And I think that's great joy already for me, because accepting and starting the PhD on public engagement on topics of waste management and sustainable energy, solar panels, windmills, yes, sustainable, great. But those were not the topics that my family and my people, that it would matter to them. So I was plotting also my escape out of academia, or at least out of this field. I wasn't getting a lot of joy from that. So I'm really, really happy that somehow Healing Afterlives of Colonialism as a project came into my journey. Because I see direct meaning of why this is such an important topic. I don't have to dive and read so many articles about the problem, what it means to people and the complexity of it. And it's meaningful. It's emotional. You get to meet lots of people and you take over emotions as well. And I get to experience also that people very close to me are not so fond of me doing this type of research. Leave that. Don't dodge that. Leave that in the past. People who sometimes I want the most support from. Yet, there is just a bigger, it's not me just doing something that I want. It's a meaning that is bigger. And I'm grateful to be able to do this then.
But what I'm really curious to hear more about is, like, you were excited about this project because you thought it was really centering the needs of the community, the experiences, the stories, and then maybe bringing a different perspective to that. But then you also say people who are close to you in your own community, they don't want you to focus on that.
Yeah.
So how do you make sense of this dilemma?
I'm learning not to take it personally.
And why do you think they're so against you focusing on it?
It can be a protective layer. It can be a coping mechanism to move on in life. And there are many thoughts around it. I think it's very nuanced. Although I feel sometimes disappointed, the ego feels disappointed because I should want the approval of, you want the approval of those around you. There's also a piece of understanding society, actually, and the difficulties out there. If you can understand where it hurts, or where it blocks, where it doesn't feel comfortable with those really close around you. I mean, if I am not able to show you so close to me how important this is, then you're coming from a different perspective and direction to be respected, to be explored, not to take personally. But it's not easy.
How have these responses made you reflect on the importance of that avenue of research?
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm, like I said, I also carry over the emotions, and sometimes I react back easily. No, well, let me not say easily, but sometimes I get in that state where I say, you're just indoctrinated.
Uh-huh.
But that's a judgment from my side, or you're ignorant. Huh? But I also realize that at some time my own ding dong wake up, that I'm pressing an alarm. I want you to see it the way I see it. But that is the complexity of it. Mm. Otherwise, this would have been solved. I mean, we would have worked towards policies and societies that meet, that are beneficial to both polarizing sides. But it takes more to understand where it doesn't go. And then I see these frictions that I have with those close around me on this topic as an opportunity to try to understand where those narratives are coming from. And I don't understand it always immediately.
I was thinking for our audience, it might be interesting to hear when you talk to the members of the community about your research, how do you explain it? Like, what is your research about when someone comes to you and talks to you about, you know, asks you about this?
Yeah, so when I say I'm a researcher now focusing on healing the afterlives of colonialism, I really pay attention to, do I insert Dutch colonialism or just colonialism? Who's around? I'm actually focusing on Dutch colonialism. But I am aware that you see sometimes the eyebrows of people go up. So
it is loaded.
It is loaded. It is a loaded topic, my God. And we are in this remembrance year. So people are confronted, whether they want it or not, with the topic and with developments there. And I am posting on my socials as well. So the first reaction is, Devin, don't try to like be, I'm doing this. No, say it in a comment, but do speak the truth. And what I've also encountered is that some people even invested in the topic don't appreciate using the word healing immediately.
Why is that?
Yeah. Because for some, healing indicates that you are beyond some other stages, which are very important, like acknowledgement, reparations, reparatory justice. Then we can speak about what does healing entails. Don't go too fast. And I can understand that. So I'm also very careful with using healing in a way that comes across like this is one definition of healing, but to open it up as well as what would healing mean to you and what would be then conditions for your healing journey or the healing journey of your community.
And how would you define healing in the way that you approach it in your work? Difficult question.
That those phases of acknowledgement of social justice, dignity, reparatory, reparations, those are elements of what in this context of healing afterlives of colonialism, what healing would mean, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, if you talk about Dutch colonialism and the different countries and people affected by it, communities affected by it, it would mean trying to understand those different communities in a nuanced way, know that they all have different pain points. They're not one fix for all. There's not one fix for all, not one healing approach to all. And it also means letting go of what we taught. And when I say we, is we institutes, we Western biomedical science, Western biomedical medicine, think that healing, that medicine, that is something that is established by Western biomedical science. It might really mean looking beyond that. And what does healing mean for the communities themselves? I mean, as humans, we didn't originate after the establishment of Western biomedical science. We were there way before it. And there were ways that people were addressing both bodily, physical, mental illnesses or deviations in a form that suited their own communities, their own context. And it was wiped out. That was wiped out. So healing for me means reclaiming that own identity and allow or go with a community there or a person, I'm thinking more collectively as well, where they as a community, as a collective can restore their own dignity, restore their own sense of self-worth. Nobody is inferior here, even though some minds try to impose that on others. To me, healing is a mental thing. It's a mind belief system that takes a lot of consciousness. But of course, we have many egos then as humans, egoic sides that hamper it. But healing means that authentic self, respecting that with dignity and listening to where they are not in that place of dignity and why.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the sense of collective healing that you mentioned, this seems to be also perhaps a part of some of your community building efforts. Zara and I actually got to experience one of the rituals that you led for us during a workshop that Zara had co-organized. Could you explain a little bit more about this ritual and how this connects to your work with the Katikoti tables?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. The Katikoti Tafel Dialogue as a stichting, a foundation, focuses on bring people together, especially polarized groups. So their intervention is one that addresses racism, inclusion and exclusion, discrimination in a way that is not necessarily only just empowering one of the groups, but really bring them together. So bring those polarized groups together and facilitate a dialogue. They have been doing this for many years, over 12, 13 years in many institutes. Now they are being hired for for the staff of the institute, but also the general public. And since last year, I also co-facilitate these dialogues. I entered in it as a form of understanding, as a researcher, not sit in that ivory tower, but go out there and be in the middle of the healing where it takes place and feel it. Not only to listen, but also to give words to all those different interpretations, right? So it connected, and I think it's an amazing intervention, inspired by the Jewish Seidetafel, which is also very relevant right now. And there are many variations that you can make with that concept of bringing people together, but also think about rituals, about food, about music, speeches, sharing in a collective way. But also have room for individuals to think for themselves, okay, what's the situation in my mind? What are the experiences that I had? Not many people get to speak about their own uncomfortable experiences in a way that somebody from the other side listens to them. And so there's a lot of power in it. Just today, I was on the phone with a former colleague who was also very inspired by this form of intervention and actually wants to use it, is inspired by it to bring together young parents, fathers and mothers who sometimes do not understand each other. They easily already ask a woman, you think like that. to bring them together and to actually exchange those experiences. And I know as well that Stichting Kitty-Kotti Tafel used this intervention to have discussions on campus around the situation of Israel and Gaza. It's also very, very polarizing. And I think it's a light yet powerful way of making these very uncomfortable, polarizing topics.
Speakable,
yeah.
You said lights, which I found interesting because I was also thinking when listening to you, it's nice that you bring people together to talk about topics that actually make us uncomfortable and not just to discuss about, you know, we have a lot in common and we should just celebrate diversity. So it's kind of a transition from that. But how do you then connect these changes in the individual minds with the systemic, just as you were just referring to, reparations at a structural level, right? Is this what you mean when you say this is a light intervention?
No, that's not what I meant.
Because you said healing also contains these aspects of reparations and justice. And how do you then bridge these layers?
So when I said light, I mean, there is laughter, there is food, there is music. Those are very simple yet powerful means to make people feel comfortable and yet speak about those dark places, experiences. How to connect it with those bigger things, reparatory justice and etc. Coming into the research of representing Europe, I knew early on, even before we got the funding, that this is not a research that is going to be done in 5 years. We didn't get here in a weekend or a year. Steps. And I not even you, Zara, my colleague, or all others of us in the project need to accomplish those great, amazing achievements and goals, ambitions in year 5. Steps. To really trying to understand here what it would take for communities, the different communities that I belong to feel in a way that justice is being addressed. And it takes time to build trust even within the communities. Lots of meetings. I'm working with a Synthostasis Burial Ground Alliance focusing on a dignified memorial for ancestors, former enslaved people on the island. I'm working with healing from the Toeslagen affaire, how to get complementary care for reimbursed by the WMO, the Dutch healthcare system. Those are topics where you're dealing with organizations that have been struggling for so long. For so, even before I was thinking about coming into this field, I am in a luxurious position where I do not have to fight that much as they did. But that means building that trust and trying to navigate yourself among people who are really, really, really hurt and disappointed by the system that has been oppressing them, by opportunities not given to them or taken away from them. And then, already having trust after a year, after 1.5 years, do activities together. Yeah, that's where I get one joy, but also those are the achievements that are in my reach, in the reach of this project from my perspective.
And they quite well connects to perhaps also the motivations of many of us academics, right? Where we get into academia, especially a social scientist, because we want to change the world. So it's a beautiful way of phrasing also that focus on achievable goals while still working towards, you know, like the grand goal.
Yeah.
Going back to your definition of these gatherings being lights, you said you meant there was laughter, there was joy, I think, also. So this is actually the topic of our podcast, and that's where I want to go next in our question. So how does joy come into picture in your research or community-related work on healing? Because you said, I wanted to be there in the middle of this, and I wanted to feel it. Do you feel joy there, or how does it come into the picture?
Joy is not a constant. So it fluctuates. It's spiral going up and down. Also, depending on when you choose to see the moments of joy, I am fully aware that I shouldn't be seeking joy while doing, you know, these activities. But if in that pain that you're experiencing and talking about with others, there are moments where you can crack out of that uncomfortness with a laughter, that is healing, that is joyful in that moment. But the joy, I think, sits in enabling these fellow community members to articulate feelings, emotions that were locked down inside. It's about creating awareness for both sides, both polarizing sides. And then in that moment, there is no immediate joy to that. But if you look back, then, and also taking into account that a lot of this, what we are doing is generational work, I might not be seeing fruits entirely that I am, you know, sowing now. So it's generational work. And then hopefully the generation after the one sitting on that table or participating in this march of protest or whatever will experience a little bit more joy. That's how I see it.
I think that beautifully connects as well to some of the discussions we've had in other episodes where joy really has like the sense of like a duality, right? So it's not just this presence of positive emotions, but also perhaps like a bit of a process that leads to perhaps joy, as you mentioned, with like the reflection. But it also involves pain, resilience, a sense of community building. Beautifully said. Yeah. So you already gave some examples where you were talking about how some of these community members perhaps experienced joy. But we were then wondering if you could walk us through a specific memory in which you experienced or practiced joy.
Yeah. For me, being able to be in the academia in a world where those around me, where I was at my activities, were mostly elderly, gray, very, very, very money focused towards, you know, profit. To change that and to find that even teaching research methods, hiring an intern or a junior coaching lecturer to possibly work with me on a topic that is so meaningful for those who look like me is a big step of joy. But connected to that, the ability to connect to spirit and to not feel trapped in any egoic illusion and or expectation of life, victim role, madness, because you get many emotions in this topic, but to be able to discharge that through to gratefulness and seeing blessings in this, seeing unconditional love in the community as well. And I personally use the power of prayer a lot to discharge and to feel grounded back. And as silly as it may sound, I looked at that question via the email. There's just no other thing that is more joyful to me than having that backbone of you don't have to take this thing personally.
Yeah. Can you open it a little bit more? What do you mean when you say you don't have to take this personally?
The frustrations that there are, the condemnations, the attacks, the criticisms, the judgments, all that arises when you get to talk about this topic, when you get to work with people in this field. Many other academics that I know are doing a research on a population or on a topic that is something completely different than where they live or where they came out of. So this is very personal research. And then, it can hurt easily, or it can also satisfy me, and we can be very happy if I see other faces. So it's both sides there too. But yet, if you want to move on in this, you don't need to take things personally.
Now that's way more clear to me, I think, because I do recognize that in my own research as well. sometimes when I feel like hopeless or when I feel like, you know, how do I find my motivation back? I think of all these young people. I think of my own family, my own nephews, and who are going through similar experiences in their educational journeys, you know, struggles with belonging, etc. And there are indeed moments of joy when I'm doing research, when I talk to them, and when I see their resilience, their resistance, and how they kind of survive within this context. That gives me a lot of joy and also a sense of purpose. But then indeed seeing the pain, seeing the suffering, and then feeling powerless also, because you're just a researcher, you know, there are limits to what you can do, what you can change. So it's kind of really happening together. All these emotions are coming together within those moments. So there's often like no pure joy almost. I guess that's what I'm hearing when I hear you saying like, don't take it personal. But it's so hard, right? When your experiences are so embedded right. in these research contexts. Yeah.
And if I think back to what you mentioned earlier, right? When you said what drew you partially to become a researcher was like this idea of these theoretical models. And it's beautiful to hear how applying these theoretical ideas to work that's quite personal. And how then, of course, that you need that sense of resilience to withstand, stand strong against certain things, certain reactions. So it's beautiful to hear these things come back, like this personal aspect of the research, the way you're applying or pursuing this like personal interest, which is also like theoretical. So it's beautiful to see these things coincide.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that probably a lot of us, as you mentioned in your situation, and I think for many of our listeners as well, that a lot of racialized scholars can recognize in their own lives and in their own work. So often it is a sense of me search. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Somewhere in our conversation, I said something about reclaiming back your identity, that it's for the communities, but it definitely also comes from myself. And the starting point of me making the switch from sustainability topics to healing afterlives of colonialism was a very small hobby research where I went into exploring traditional healing in my own communities as actually a reaction to why is it that my neighbor from the left side and the other one from the right side, and it can be family members, think differently about this. And what is that conflict internally? So that it's part of reclaiming the identity that I am, the communities where I come from. And there's no shame in that. There's no condemnation as well in that. And so once I started to heal that part in me, the thoughts that I had on that, that also helps to make thinking about healing on the other things more easier. If it was the other way around, I'm not focusing on the internal stuff. In Dutch, I would say, daar heb ik geen recht van spreken. Then I wouldn't have the right to speak about it. I find, but that's my personal meaning, not just talk the talk, but walk the walk too. That's just me. And so I find it way more meaningful now in the academia, and then also way more joyful when it has this deeper meaning.
And in terms of walk the walk, I mean, this Kitty Kutty table project is a great example of actually walking the walk and not just staying, you know, in that ivory tower and hoping that one day this research will reach someone, right? You're actually doing or walking the
yeah.
Walking the talk.
Walking the walk.
Walking the walk. Walking the walk. Yes, yes, yes.
I guess that brings us to our final question, although you're sharing so many interesting things about your research and community work. We could keep going with this conversation, but we finally would like to ask your advice for those who want to pursue an academic career. What would you say to them?
And then especially I'm talking to those from my communities. Work hard. You know, it's good to dream big. I went back home to Suriname just a few weeks ago for a long 7-6 week workation, holidays too. And then my elderly cousin, Dino, who I consider a brother, told me after like so long that we have spoken, we don't speak that often deeply on the phone here. Actually, you're a pilot. You bring people, communities from one point to another. You listen to where they want to go. I was like, wow, Dino. Nice. So dream big. Whatever you want to become, and put in the work, But I would really say release attaching to any specific outcome, because you really don't know how your pet really should be looking at. And then from a very spiritual advice, I mean, in every challenge and in every difficulty, there are so many lessons, beautiful lessons of patience with yourself and accepting the situation yourself and having compassion. Those are really, really beautiful lessons. And sometimes those really close to you do not understand you or the choices you make. And then you might think, why is the world against me? Well, it can be your brother, your mother, your sister. But know that really those, the closest to us, if they can touch us, yeah, only they can touch us. Only they can allow us to accept them also with those thoughts and to have unconditional love to them and to ourselves. So go for it. But know that your path is your journey as it will unfold. And that's a blessing if you can see that. So enjoy that. Enjoy that.
indeed. I think take away, right, just to shortly summarize it, is this: on one hand, this beautiful connection that you've been able to make, right, between the research that you do and these community building efforts, right, the relation between healing and joy. And even when there's tension in our community, still being able to pursue this kind of research that benefits not just ourselves, but the people around us. Thank you so much, Derwin, for your time and healing reflections, helping us heal, helping us gain a sense of joy. I think this is a great ending to our episode today. Thank you all for listening. This was a conversation on Join Academia with Derwin Lynch. Stay tuned for our next episode.